climbed over and up onto it quickly, shielding himself from being seen from inside the second floor. He saw no fast way down to the ground floor other than a straight drop of 12 feet. It was just sidewalk below, so he decided against this approach. Instead, he lay down on his stomach on the window unit, and it creaked and squeaked against the strain. Feeling down below it, he was happy to find braces that led at 45-degree angles to anchor into the wall of the building, and he held on to one of these, lowered himself off the unit, and swung down below it. With his feet just 3 feet off the ground now, he dropped the rest of the way onto the sidewalk. Here, dozens of men and women, patrons of the bar mostly, stood around. Parked in the street not far away, Court saw two Toyota Hilux pickup trucks bearing the symbol of the NDF, the National Forces, the pro-government militia that had been co-opted as a secondary law enforcement entity here in the police state of Damascus. The vehicle seemed to be unmanned, and Court thought about stealing one to get away. But since there were people watching him right now, and since the phone he'd gone through so much to get was still sitting in the garbage behind the disco, he decided to go for that instead. Court entered the front door of Bar 80 now, heading to the back exit. There were a surprising number of patrons still inside, idiots all, Court told himself, and the police and NDF were all over the place. With Court's dark hair, beard, and civilian clothing, he didn't stick out in the crowd, so he just moved through, heading to the back exit so he could get to the alley. As he passed the stairwell, a group of police and NDF descended, with Saunders at their center. He was handcuffed, his upper lip was fat. The buttons of his shirt had been ripped off, and sweat mixed with a little smeared blood on his bald head. The Brit, who had been cursing out the cops in Arabic, saw the man he knew as Wade and switched into English.
"You lucky prick, how did they miss you?"
Court kept walking, but gave the man a wink.
"Find Walid and get back space. Don't go alone. You'll get popped at a checkpoint if you try. We'll be out in a few hours, but Brunetti's got himself a busted nose."
Court nodded but kept walking towards the back. He didn't want the cops to pay any attention to him. At the back door, he turned around and looked towards the stairs. Brunetti, Anders, and Braz all were being led out in restraints by NDF and police, along with Russians and even Syrian Tiger Forces soldiers. Court was alone. He exited the back door, stepped into the alley, and walked over to the garbage can. The phone was still there, lying on a pile of beer bottles. He plucked it out, wiped it on the leg of his cargo pants, and then began running off, back in the direction of Walid's car. He realized the opportunity he had now. This was no longer about finding 5 minutes to make a phone call before deploying to another part of the nation tomorrow. Instead, Court knew he had to go for the baby. Right now. No. This wasn't a perfect situation, far from it, but he would have to make it work. Chapter 37. Court was astonished to find Walid in the parking lot by his car, still holding the bottle of Jack Daniels in his hand. The Desert Hawks officer had apparently staggered out of the club with the booze, and while he was obviously shit-faced drunk, Court determined he was not drunk enough to suit Court's purposes. Together, both men took a swig out of the bottle, and they spent a few seconds talking about the fight that had just taken place. Court's sudden rudimentary Arabic surprised the major. Walid took a second swig of the booze, and then Court directed him to the front passenger seat of the car. Court climbed behind the wheel, took the keys from a compliant Walid, and then began driving west through Old Town Damascus. After less than a minute on the road, however, Walid looked out the windshield, then told Court, in slurred Arabic, that he was going the wrong way. In response, Court encouraged him to drink some more whiskey. Walid did so. And as soon as he lowered the bottle, Court removed his own seatbelt, then carefully shifted in his seat. He turned his body to the side so he could face Walid and drive at the same time with his left hand. Walid noticed the odd positioning, and he looked at Court with dopey, tired, and just slightly puzzled eyes.
"What are you doing?"
Court answered by firing a blazing right jab out, connecting with Walid's left eye socket and knocking him flat against the passenger window. The big man went unconscious, then slumped forward, hanging there by his seatbelt. A minute later, Court pulled into a dark parking lot at the edge of the old town. Here, he climbed out, then looked under the dashboard of the car, using the light of the mobile phone to help him. He began identifying fuses that led to different lights in the vehicle. He pulled out the fuse for the rear lights and the brake lights until the lights went out when he tried to deploy them. But he left the fuses barely in place so he could unplug them easily. Righting himself in the driver's seat, he leaned down and indexed the correct fuses so he could both disconnect and reconnect them without looking. He spilled a little of the Jack Daniels on the major's tunic and put the bottle in the unconscious man's right hand. He pulled Waleed's head back to where he didn't look completely out of it, and when the drunk man's head drooped forward again, Court lowered the angle of his seat back a few degrees so that his head would stay up. Court looked at the man through the window with the door closed. He hoped if he got stopped at a checkpoint, he could talk his way through with a story about how the major had passed out and Court was taking him home. This was not a good plan, Court knew, but he didn't know what else he could do. He got back on the road, and while he drove, he opened the secure communications app on the cell phone and dialed a long number. It took a full minute for the call to go through, but when it did, Vincent Voland answered quickly. Court said, "It's me. I'm here."
"In Damascus? Already?"
"Yep."
"Incredible. Any problems?"
"Nothing but problems. Problems all over the fucking place, as a matter of fact, but I made it. I'm operational, and I need to talk to Bianca, now."
"Of course. I'm heading downstairs to her room to put her on the phone."
Court drove the Hyundai one-handed, holding the phone to his ear with the other. While he waited, he asked, "Any sign of Drexler?"
"No sign at all, but that means nothing. He's coming. I feel it in my bones."
"Have you beefed up security there at the house?"
We are ready, should he bring associates."
Court could only hope Voland had the situation in hand up there, because Court had more than his share of problems of his own down here. Seconds later, Bianca came on the line. She had a hopeful sound to her voice, which buoyed Court to hear.
"Is it you?"
"It's me. I'm in Damascus."
"I did not think I would ever hear from you again."
"No time to talk. I need your address, and I need you to tell me the best way to get to your place."
"Of course. Where are you exactly?"
"I'm leaving Old Town, heading west towards Meza. I'm going for Jamal right now."
"Now? You can't be on the road at this time of night. They'll spot you."
"Unfortunately, this isn't something I can take care of on my lunch hour tomorrow." Court saw a line of brake lights on the road ahead, and he worried it might indicate a checkpoint. He scanned around quickly for some way to turn off, and he looked down at the map on the phone for help as well. He slowed and took a left turn down a darkened side street. This led him to the south, and on the phone, he saw he could pick up an east-west street that would put him back on course. Bianca spoke through the speakerphone.
"Hello? Are you there?"
"I'm here."
"Please listen to me."
He could hear the worry in her voice.
"I drive at night from Old Town and must pass through several roadblocks. My security detail gets me through, but who's going to get you through without them catching you?"
Court turned and looked at the passed-out militia major slumped against the passenger door next to him. "Let me worry about that," he said, but the truth was, he was very worried about that.
"What street are you on?"
The street signs were in Arabic and English, and Court rolled past an intersection with his eyes on the signs.
"I'm on Fawaz al-Laham."
"There is a checkpoint on Fawaz al-Laham where it turns into Omar bin Abdulaziz."
Court made another turn to the south that took him down a quiet street with tall apartment buildings on both sides. He gave her the name, and she said,
"No checkpoints, but that won't get you to my house. I live in Meza District in the Western Villas neighborhood. You'll have to turn around."
"Shit, okay. I'm going to keep picking my way west, and I'll tell you what I see. Get Voland to pull up a map on a computer or a phone, and you can talk me to your neighborhood." In under a minute, Voland relayed that he had his computer open to an interactive map.
"All right,"
Bianca said.
"I am ready. The good news is I know where the checkpoints are, but the bad news is that to get into my neighborhood, you have to pass a guard shack and gates. I live on Zayd bin Al-Khattab, number 36.
Bianca was adamant that he should not drive all the way into her neighborhood. She claimed there would be a large checkpoint and security officers patrolling in a truck within a few blocks of where she lived. So she convinced him to go to a less active neighborhood a kilometer away and use the night to his advantage to close on the property. She spent several minutes giving relative details of her home, and while she talked, Court listened. But he also focused on avoiding any roadblocks, busy intersections where he might be spotted, or major thoroughfares. It was slow going, but he kept heading to the west. Minutes later, he found a place to park up a hill from her home. Over the sound of a snoring Walid, Court asked Bianca more questions about the walls, windows, guards, neighbors, vehicles on the street, and police and military presence in the area. He committed it all to memory and tried to think of any possible information he might need in the next couple hours. When Court had exhausted all his questions about the property, the personnel, and the area around it, he changed focus.
Tell me about your situation there.
I'm still in the room in the basement, but Rima is coming down and talking to me 2 times a day.
Court imagined there was some indoctrination or deprogramming going on during those talks, but he didn't bring it up.
How many guards does Volant have around you?
I have no idea. I saw some European men today, 2 or 3 of them, but there might be more. They had guns.
He wished he knew more about just what Volant and the Halabis were doing to protect Bianca, but he had no time to dig into the matter further.
Court said, Tell me something that only you and Yasmin know, so I can establish to her that you sent me.
Bianca thought of something, told Court, then said,
If she refuses to go with you, call me and I'll talk to her.
Court had no illusions that he would be able to make phone calls while in the house confronting Yasmin. He had to just hope like hell he could convince her to comply. If not, he figured he'd tie and gag her, throw her in a closet, and leave her for the security men to sort out the next morning. Bianca said,
Good luck. Please hug and kiss Jamal for me when you see him, and tell him his mommy misses him.
This ain't the movies.
I'm sorry?
Let me talk to Volant.
Court expected Volant to come back on the line, but instead, Rima Halabi's voice crackled over the connection.
Sir, I know you don't want to use any of my connections, but I must give you the name of someone there in the city who can be a great help to you if you have any difficulties.
You don't know that this person is not compromised.
He's been living in the capital for years while helping us to move aid to the rebels from abroad. If his actions were known to the authorities, there is no chance he wouldn't have been thrown in Sednaya prison long ago. He is a surgeon at a regime hospital. He spends his days saving the lives and limbs of young soldiers, but he knows what's going on in the other parts of the nation, and he refuses to turn his back on any Syrian in need. He's helped relief agencies get supplies into the war zones in the north, and he saved thousands of lives by his actions. He is a good man, and if you tell him we sent you, he will help you in any way he can.
She then gave him the address and phone number of the doctor. Court had to commit both to memory.
Are you in contact with him?
Court asked. Rima replied,
I haven't spoken to him directly in 2 years, but I am able to get messages to him.
Do not reach out to him about me. If I get desperate, I'll know where to find him.
Court spoke with Volant a moment more, and then he hung up. In the dark parking garage, he went through Walid's car quickly. He found the backpack the major had put his uniform in when he changed into civilian clothes outside Bar 80, and while Walid was a much thicker man than Court, Court knew the uniform would give him at least a momentary advantage when walking through Bianca Medina's neighborhood. He quickly dressed in the Hawks Brigade uniform and put his own boots back on, leaving Walid's boots in the trunk of the Hyundai. In the trunk, he also found Walid's emergency bag, set up for if the major was caught off base during a terror attack or civil strife. It was filled with food, water, and medical supplies, as well as other items. From the bag, Court took a pair of binoculars, a flashlight, and a long but cheaply built fixed-blade knife in a sheath. Then he went around to the passenger side and pulled Walid himself out of the car. He tied the unconscious man's hands behind his back with rope pulled from the emergency bag, then hog-tied his hands to his ankles and gagged him. Court then dragged and hefted the big man from the passenger seat and rolled him into the trunk of the car. He closed the trunk lid on the major, put the extra items into the uniform backpack, and threw it onto his shoulder. At 1 a.m., he began walking off through the neighborhood. Chapter 38 Captain Henri Sauvage wanted to smoke, but the Syrian communications team working around him forbade it. The tension was high here on the dark, wet country road in the center of the woods, so Sauvage didn't know how he was going to survive without a cigarette. But he didn't press the issue. The Syrians were dangerous-looking men with intense, angry demeanors, their hands never far away from the submachine guns under their leather jackets, or the small hooked knives in the sheaths near their belt buckles. The two men here with Sauvage were tasked with using the big, heavy jamming equipment in the car to kill the cell phone and internet traffic in the area. Another man was on a telephone pole on the northern side of the property, waiting for the cue from Malik to cut the hard lines into the house. In front of Sauvage, six more men, all dressed in dark clothing, moved off through the thick trees, separating as they walked through the rainy night. Drexler was at the center of the group, picking through the foliage next to Malik, and both men were easy to distinguish because, unlike the others, they wielded pistols. When they fully disappeared from view through the dark and the woods, Sauvage leaned back against the white sedan. As the two Syrians worked on laptops on the hood, the Frenchman's only job was to sit here and wait. Sauvage told himself this would all be over soon, but he didn't really believe it. This event was going to be big and loud, he was certain. An outcome that involved him staying both alive and out of prison was getting harder and harder to imagine. 100 meters to the east, Sebastian Drexler adjusted the night vision optics over his eyes and moved along with the rest of the Syrian commando force. He'd been on special forces raids in a half dozen African and Middle Eastern countries over his career, usually without night vision, but always with a weapon and surrounded by paramilitary forces that rushed through the desert, jungle, urban center, or grassy plains towards some objective. From this expertise, he determined that these Syrians were unquestionably well-trained. Even with the fuzzy, two-dimensional image afforded by the night vision, they were able to negotiate their way adroitly through the thick flora. They kept their separation from one another, and they advanced on the target location in near complete silence. Five more Syrians would be making their way through the woods around the southern end of the property, with the objective of hitting the farmhouse on the front side. The communications team, along with Sauvage, was also ready to move vehicles around to the front of the house, or even to provide a follow-on attacking force if the situation called for it. Drexler struggled to keep up with the Syrian commandos, but he knew he needed to exert his authority over all aspects of this operation. Malik was the epitome of an alpha male, and if Drexler backed off at all, Malik would walk all over him. If that happened, he'd lose his chance at achieving his true objective here. He did not want or need a large battle this evening. Too much noise would bring a lot of law enforcement, and that would make flying out of Paris tomorrow difficult, if not impossible. If he could get out of here with the woman without this turning into a loud and flashy massacre, then he could more easily get out of France and get to Serbia, where he'd eventually be free of the Syrian GIS men and have the time, space, and opportunity he needed to take care of Bianca Medina. After moving through the trees for 10 minutes, Malik called a halt over his radio, and the line of men stopped as one. Malik and Drexler picked their way forward carefully until they came to the edge of the woods. Sebastian Drexler saw the back of the French country estate now. It was completely enshrouded in darkness, with the windows blacked out and all the external lighting extinguished. But even though it was sprinkling and overcast, the house could not hide from the night vision goggles, which pulled the tiny amount of ambient light from the stars above and enhanced it. The home appeared as a large, barely distinguishable green haze, but soon movement caught the attention of Malik and Drexler both. A pair of men stood on a patio. They held short-barreled weapons and shifted from one foot to another, bored and unaware of the danger in the woods 100 meters from their position. As Drexler looked on, a white-haired man stepped outside and spoke with the two guards for a moment. Drexler reached over to Malik. "Hand me your 5-power night vision binoculars." Malik did so, and Drexler swiveled his unenhanced goggles up on his forehead so he could bring the binos to his eyes. He looked at the white-haired man for some time through the night vision binoculars. Slowly, a smile widened on Drexler's face. "Vincent Voland is here."
"Yes, we know." Malik looked at Drexler. "You two know each other?" "We've never met, but I know who he is. An ex-French intelligence man, both foreign and domestic. He's been after me for years. Tonight, he'll get his wish to see me up close. Doubtful the event will go as he had dreamed it might." Malik took the binos back and looked through them himself. He won't see you up close. We're not here for you to participate in some old feud. We're here to rescue the girl, and then we leave. Believe me, I know exactly why we are here, Drexler replied. Malik took his eyes out of his binoculars and looked at Drexler, but he made no reply. He looked again through the night vision. After a few seconds, the silver-haired man by the pool turned and stepped back into the house. Malik radioed his communications team and ordered them to begin jamming operations in the area. He then brought two members of his team forward and whispered to Drexler,
I'm sending a pair of men closer to eliminate the rear sentries silently. They'll use knives. We need to be ready to advance quickly when this is done.
How are your men going to get across 100 meters of open ground? It's dark, but it's not that dark.
They'll low crawl. It will take a half hour. And I'll have sharpshooters ready to drop the guards if my men are spotted. That will not happen quietly. So in that case, we need to be prepared to attack the house from right here.
Drexler didn't want to attack the Syrian expat safe house from here. It would be noisy and exponentially more dangerous to do so. And he knew a gunfight would bring authorities into the area, and that could waylay his plan to reach Bianca Medina. But the fact that Vincent Voland was at the property now gave him a new idea. He said,
No, tell your men to wait.
Wait for what?
For me to negotiate the terms of Voland's surrender.
Drexler removed the holstered Beretta from inside his jacket and put it down on the ground. He removed the revolver from his ankle and the extra magazines and a folding knife from his jacket. He took off his night vision goggles and stacked them with the other items. He then pulled out a tiny tactical flashlight from his pocket. Turning it on, he stood and began walking across the back lawn alone. Malik called out to him in a whisper.
What the fuck are you doing?
Drexler ignored him. Chapter 39. Court had wanted high ground that would give him a good view of the movements inside Bianca Medina's walled property, and he found it by heading up a hill to the east of her neighborhood, entering the open parking lot of a pool and fountain supply store, and climbing the wall of the building by using hand and footholds afforded by a stone planter, a PVC pipe protecting electrical wiring, and a wooden sign. Court was a nimble climber, and in seconds he was kneeling on the roof, Waleed's binos in his hands, looking some 400 yards down the hill. Past a mosque, past an upscale pizza parlor, and past several other private homes, he could see right into the gated rear grounds of Bianca's walled property. From his vantage point, there were areas within her property he could not see, but the entire back half of the compound, including a tiled swimming pool, the garden around it, and the back windows of the large two-story home, was in view. The villa had Mediterranean architecture and was built in a U-court shape, with wings extending back perpendicularly to the main house on both sides, a courtyard in the center, and a high wall in back that closed off the courtyard. There was no question that it was a nice residence, but considering that the man paying the bills for the place was the most powerful and wealthy man in the nation, it wasn't all that ostentatious. All around in the neighborhood were dozens of properties of similar size and luxury. Court knew that Ahmed crafted everything towards Shakira not finding out about Bianca and the baby, so even though Bianca had been living in plain sight here, Ahmed wasn't going to have her living in a home so grandiose it invited special scrutiny from the neighbors. Through his glass, Court saw a single guard on the flat roof of the villa sitting on a chair on the eastern side and facing the street in front of the property and the short circular driveway to it. The large court area in back seemed to be unguarded, but Court suspected there would be cameras and motion detectors. After a minute of searching, he saw a patrolling guard with a flashlight and a short-barreled weapon with a folded wire stock walking slowly around the grounds.
Nope, Court said to himself. No motion detectors to worry about.
He'd asked Bianca about the security force, and she'd said nothing about a patrolling sentry. Court hoped this was the only way Azam had beefed up the security of the residence in the past few days. It would be tough to get in, but it didn't look like it would be much tougher than the 100 other buildings Court had infiltrated in his career. Court continued scanning the scene, over and over, back and forth with the binos. Softly to himself on the rooftop, he said,
What am I missing?
There had to be another level to the security. Ahmed Azam knew Bianca was missing up in France, and he also knew this was where her son, Ahmed's son, was being kept. Because of matters out of his full control, Ahmed could not risk moving Jamal. But even if Ahmed trusted Bianca implicitly, Court couldn't believe for an instant the one stationary guard, who looked as relaxed as he could be, plus another bored guy roving the grounds, would be the full measure of the external security set up here.
Where are you?
Through the binoculars, he scanned the property once more, then widened his search to the streets nearby. And now he had his answer. Bianca had warned there would be security at the front gate of the neighborhood, but scanning around inside, Court saw vehicles of the NDF, the National Defense Forces. 3 parked NDF trucks in all. It could easily mean 15 armed militiamen, all within 200 yards of the front door of Bianca's house. This was why the regular security force had relaxed its guard, despite the heightened threat to the location. The neighborhood was protected. The actual block Medina lived on was protected. The front gate of her property was protected. And the grounds were protected, albeit by only a couple of goons who realized they were the fourth ring in from danger, and therefore probably assumed they would be well aware of any threats long before the grounds were breached. And Court figured it would be safe to assume there would be security men inside the home as well. He focused on the closest National Defense Forces unit, parked in a military SUV ahead and on Court's right, equidistant between himself and Bianca's home. Through his binos, he saw 3 men standing by the vehicle, all with rifles slung on their shoulders. He figured these guys had no idea they were here protecting one particular home. They'd just been sent to an intersection, likely night after night after night, and although he was certain their leadership read them the riot act about remaining vigilant, it was human nature to let one's guard down as the hours and days began adding up. He figured if he could get over the fence into the gated neighborhood, he could probably get close enough to take these bozos out without making too much noise, but maybe he didn't have to. He looked down to the uniform he wore and compared it to the uniform worn by the NDF men. Other than some extra patches on the shoulders of the Desert Hawks Brigade tunic and a slightly more involved camo pattern, the tunic and pants looked virtually the same. The NDF men had black berets, and Major Waleed had left the base with only an olive-green baseball cap in the back pocket of his trousers, but Court figured his own dark hair and his short beard that looked just like the short beards worn by a third of the men in their 20s and 30s around here, along with his I-know-what-I'm-doing attitude, would get him close to the compound, especially if he moved outside the glow of the electric lights of the streets in the neighborhood. Court took another minute to plot his approach through the streets, alleys, commercial spaces, and residential property between himself and Bianca's home near the bottom of the hill, then climbed down from the pool and fountain shop. He muttered to himself as he descended, "Okay, gentry, time to steal a baby." Chapter 40 Former French Foreign Legionnaires Boyer and Novak stood on the rear steps of the farmhouse outside Paris, with their Heckler and Koch MP5 submachine guns held on their shoulders at the ready, their barrels aiming to a figure approaching from the woodline. In the distance, the single flashlight bobbed and jittered as it closed, a man clearly walking behind it. Boyer said,
"Call it into the others,"
as Novak radioed Campbell and Lakhari at the front of the house, warning them to be ready. The door to the hearthroom off the farmhouse opened behind them. Boyer chanced to look back, and he saw Tarek Halabi standing there in corduroy pants and a dark cardigan, his eyes on the light closing on the house from the back lawn. His voice revealed his concern.
"Who is that?"
In French, Boyer answered,
"We don't know, but if he tries anything, he dies."
When the light was just 40 yards away, Boyer called out in English,
"Stop where you are!"
The light stopped moving, and then it clicked off. A voice in French replied,
"I am unarmed. I will comply with all your orders, messieurs."
The 2 men illuminated the figure with their weapon lights. The man covered his face and eyes with his hands to block it from his eyes.
"This could be a trick," Tarek said,
and this annoyed Boyer, who hadn't spent the vast majority of his 55 years in third world hellholes just so he could be told how to do his job by a surgeon with an address on the left bank of Paris. Still, Halabi was the client, so Boyer just said,
Go back inside, Doctor. We'll search him and bring him to you for questioning.
Halabi did as instructed, shutting the door behind him. Novak called out to the man in the light now.
Turn around and step backwards with your hands raised.
The figure obeyed, but as he stepped up a gentle slope in the grass and through a waist-high hedge, he looked back in the direction of the two men holding guns on him.
Turn back around,
ordered Boye. But the man only halfway turned, and he stopped moving. After a moment, he called out,
Paul? Paul Boye? Is that you?
Boye looked to Novak, who looked back to Boye. The Frenchman said,
Who the fuck is asking?
The man with his hands raised laughed loud enough to be heard across the patio.
What are the chances, my friend? It's me, Sebastian. We worked together in Malawi. Again in Entebbe, not so many years ago.
Boye lowered his weapon.
Drexler? In the flesh. As I said, I'm unarmed. So if you would do me the courtesy of not shooting me, I would greatly appreciate it.
Boye looked to Novak now, but kept his gun up and on Drexler.
Go check him out, and be careful. He's a sly fox.
Drexler heard this, and he chuckled in the dark.
How's that exquisite wife of yours, Paul?
She left me, married a Kenyan government minister.
Never could stand that bitch, if you don't mind my saying.
Not in the least. Have you been, Drex?
Tarek Halabi stood in the hearth room at the back of the house, his hands on his hips, as Sebastian Drexler was brought inside by the two ex-legionnaires. Novak returned to the rear grounds, but Boye remained behind Drexler, his weapon low, but ready to raise it in a hurry if necessary. Tarek spoke to the prisoner.
Do you speak French?
I do, Doctor. In fact, you and I have spoken before on the phone the other day.
Tarek's eyes widened.
Eric?
Correct.
Why are you here?
Drexler said, With apologies and with respect, I will speak with Monsieur Vincent Volland alone, or I will not speak at all. I should, however, let you know that I have colleagues close by, and, unlike me, they have not come this evening to talk. I only ask that you allow me to speak with Vincent with an aim to preventing a very unfortunate event from taking place tonight.
Tarek asked,
What makes you think I know this Vincent Volland you speak of?
Drexler smiled.
Because 5 minutes ago I saw him enter this door right here.
Please, Doctor. There is not much time. Let's not play games.
Chapter 41 Like a knife through butter, Court passed the first and second rings of defense with ease. He'd entered the grounds of a mosque, then climbed the wall into Bianca's gated Western Villas neighborhood via a Turkish pine, and dropped down into the paved and walled rear courtyard of a patisserie. He moved in the dark through the cafe tables of the closed eatery, then climbed a smaller stone lattice wall, and found himself two streets over from Bianca's home. Just as Bianca had suggested, it was clear now to Court that security here had indeed been heightened in light of what had happened in Paris. But also, as she'd guessed, it was also clear that Jamal was still here. Court could imagine no other reason for all the guns and guys. A Toyota Hilux pickup bearing the colors and insignia of the NDF drove by with two men in the cab and two more sitting in the bed. Once they were passed, Court crossed the two-lane street and entered the property of a small apartment complex, passing a lighted guard shack and the man inside it by no more than 25 feet. At the rear of this property, he looked down a gentle hill through a gardened property and to a road beyond. Halfway down the road, an NDF vehicle was parked, and at the far end sat the target location, Medina's Mediterranean-style home. Court descended the hill in the dark and walked through the property, and a motion light turned on. A door opened on a second-floor balcony, and a man looked out into the light. Court gave the man a bored wave and kept walking. The man waved back, seeing the uniform, no doubt, and closed the door behind him. Court marched along the street for a moment, still in the dark, and was seen by a pair of teenagers holding each other while leaning against the wall of a parking garage adjacent to an apartment building. They paid him little attention and quickly returned to their intimate moment. It occurred to Court that in many of the Middle Eastern nations he'd visited, This unmarried girl, alone with this boy, would find themselves in a great deal of trouble. Here in Syria, however, the nation's liberal views protected them, even if its leadership threatened to condemn them all to death in a never-ending civil war. He skirted the NDF men in the street by moving through another apartment building property, but this meant he found himself walking through lighted areas next to men and women still out past 1 a.m. on this Sunday morning. A small market was open, an outdoor cafe cooked sizzling meat on a grill, and he passed a tea shop with tables spilling out into the common areas of the apartment building where men and women smoked hookahs. Court marched straight through it all, even past a pair of Syrian police officers who acknowledged him with little head bobs, but he maintained his visage of authority, his air of entitlement to be exactly where he was, doing exactly what he was doing. No one gave him a second glance, and no one thought of him after he passed. A minute later, he moved back into the dark, through the private gardens next door to Medina's walled home. His eyes scanned for lights, guards, motion detectors, homeowners, and dogs, and when a Syrian police car rolled to a stop next to the NDF vehicle, Court just held his position against the wall in the forecourt of the residence until he satisfied himself that the arrival of the cops did not mean he'd been sighted. He moved out again and soon reached the wall that adjoined Bianca's rear courtyard. He pulled himself up onto the 8-foot-high masonry partition. Once he was settled, he peeked over the edge of the wall in an attempt to spot the roving guard. It was too dark to make out the man, but he could see a flashlight moving around the northern wing of the home towards the front of the grounds. He hoisted himself quickly over and then hung down, dropped silently onto the tiles along the wall, and began moving up towards the house. He avoided pathway lighting by stepping into garden beds, and soon he passed the tiled pool and arrived at a cluster of patio furniture protected just under the second-floor balcony that ran the length of the base of the U-shaped house. Court moved between a sofa and a large chair and knelt down, placing his back to a wall that ran perpendicular to three sets of doors to the home. A large set of glass double doors was in the middle, covered on the inside with curtains, and next to the doors on the outside wall was a keypad for the alarm system. 20 feet to the left of the double doors was a single sliding glass door. Court imagined it would lead to a downstairs bedroom, and on the far right, 50 feet from where Court knelt, was a single wooden door. This might have led to the kitchen, or perhaps to a garden room. He saw no movement through any of the windows, but he was sure there were armed men inside. Bianca had explained to him that the guards he'd find on the property were a Ba'ath Party security unit made up of only Alawis. Ahmed pulled from this unit to staff his presidential protection detail, so it was no surprise he used other members as his clandestine security force to look over the woman he saw as the future First Lady. And since they were Alawi, they would not hold any sectorial or familial allegiance to Shakira Azam, a Sunni Muslim. Whoever was in the house right now, Court knew they would have more skill than the NDF men he'd waltzed past to get there, and since he could see the red light on the alarm keypad by the door, he also knew the three exterior doors at the rear of the home would all be alarmed and, most likely, locked. Getting inside the house itself was always going to be one of the trickiest parts of his operation. Coming here tonight, without the benefit of the tools he'd hoped to acquire for a successful break-in, meant he had to be flexible about his points of entry. And he'd have to be as patient as he could be, while still keeping in account the fact that he wanted to be at the Jordanian border before the sun came up in 6 hours. He had the alarm code that Bianca had given him, but he had no way of knowing if it had been changed since she'd been kidnapped, and the last thing he wanted to do was key in a string of numbers that would set alarms squealing all over the grounds. He knew he could grab one of the outside guards and get the number from him, but he was hoping to avoid any chance of detection as long as possible. He moved to the sliding glass door, careful to keep from being seen through the glass by anyone in the room. As he got to the wall next to it, he peered around the side and saw it was indeed a bedroom, but there was no one inside. He didn't try the door, even if it had been unlocked. The home alarm system was engaged, so opening it was the last thing he wanted to do. Instead, he looked inside at the track the door would travel along to open, checking it for any secondary bracing or locking system. He saw nothing and decided this door would be his entry point when the time was right. For now, he retreated a few feet on the patio, tucked himself into the darkest corner of the grounds near the door, and waited. his eyes on the alarm keypad by the double doors, 25 feet away. He was hoping a roving guard might switch positions with a static man inside. A man inside might step out to check on his mates, or a person in the house would decide they needed some fresh air. In any of these cases, someone would have to turn off the alarm, and Court told himself he'd be ready. Court couldn't wait all night for good luck, but he told himself he'd give it an hour before tackling the guy with a flashlight and beating the alarm code out of him. Brute force often wasn't the best option, but sometimes it was the only option. Chapter 42. Vincent Voland had dressed for bed and lain down on the sofa in the library of the farmhouse, on the far side of the property from the activity at the back, but after taking a minute to change back into his suit and arm himself, he was brought into the kitchen by one of the Syrian guards. Here, Tariq Halabi told him the man he'd been warning everyone about was sitting on a bench in the hearth room. He was unarmed, and he said he had come to prevent a tragedy. Voland smiled at this. Drexler probably had a car full of half-drunk French cops up the road whom he'd use as a bargaining chip to get Medina handed to him without a fight. It wouldn't work. Voland would simply take Drexler into custody and pass him over to French authorities, and if the dirty cops came up the drive, the house full of armed Syrians and the four veteran security men would make short work of them. Voland took an extra moment to compose himself, to steel his mind to finally meet Drexler face to face, and to control his hands from shaking with the excitement of finally catching this elusive quarry. To Tariq he asked,
"Are all six of your men inside the house?"
"Yes. The legionnaires are outside, but my men are inside. I have three resting and three watching the property from second-story windows."
"Tell them all to be ready."
He stormed past Tariq without another word and disappeared into the hearth room. Seconds after Voland left the kitchen, Rima stepped up from the wine cellar where she had been watching over Bianca. She saw the worried look on her husband's face.
"What is it?"
"They're here," Tariq replied.
"What do we do?"
"I have no idea." And with this, he pulled her close and hugged her.
Sebastian Drexler sat on an old bench in the hearth room, eyeing Voland as he entered from the kitchen. The older Frenchman's wavy silver hair was a little askew, telling Drexler the man had been lying down, and he saw that Voland had a pistol jammed into his waistband under his jacket. Drexler said,
"A gun in the pants? Really? I didn't take you for a man of action."
Voland put his hand on the grip of the Walther self-consciously.
"Yes, well, when killers are bearing down on one's location, one must take precautions."
He sat in a wooden chair across from the Swiss agent, looking him up and down as he did so.
"I've seen photos of you, of course, but you're younger looking than I expected for a man who's caused so much trouble for so long."
Drexler gave a half shrug.
"I got an early start on my career in mayhem, I guess."
"I was thinking it was the plastic surgery."
Drexler smiled, unoffended.
"You know I have been looking for you for a long time."
"Of course I know. You could have had me in Tripoli, in fact. You hesitated, and I got away. Indecision is a recurring theme in your career that I've noted over the years."
Voland nodded.
"Well, you can trust that I won't hesitate tonight."
"We shall see," Drexler replied.
Voland regarded the comment, then asked,
"Why did you come here like this?"
"As I told Dr. Halabi, I am here to prevent further catastrophe. Simply put, you are seriously outgunned, Vincent. A few Syrian expats and some over-the-hill mercenaries aren't going to slow down what's waiting out there in the trees."
Voland chuckled.
"If I thought we were in danger, I would simply contact the local police. There is a station in La Brosse. They could be here in minutes."
Drexler shook his head.
"I doubt that. You are working off book tonight. And if the police come, you'll go to a prison for kidnapping Medina and causing death and chaos in the streets of Paris. No. You are affiliated with like-minded intelligence officials inside the French government. But you have no sanction for any of this. You are not going to reach out to the police."
Voland didn't seem fazed by being called out like this.
"Actually, you are correct. But while I may not call the gendarmerie myself, someone else here certainly will, especially if they are in fear for their lives. I am a consultant. I am not in charge.
Drexler smiled.
The landline is cut. The mobiles are jammed.
Voland had not expected this, Drexler saw. He reached into his pocket for his phone and checked it. After confirming Drexler's assertion, he looked up.
I'm impressed. But you've underestimated us. We have a satellite phone.
Which is nothing more than a radio that connects to a satellite network. They are jammable too, Vincent, over a limited area.
He waved a hand in the air.
Like if you know the exact house the sat phone is located in, for example.
With a frown, he added,
Technology is hard to keep up with, true. But maybe you should have tried a little harder before bringing these poor people out into the country where they could be so easily surrounded.
Voland cleared his throat. Now the insecurity was clear, both on his face and in his voice.
What is it you are offering?
I want the girl. That's all. Give her to me and you will walk out of here.
So you can kill her to satisfy Shakira Al-Azam.
It's more complicated than that, I'm afraid. And it's more complicated for you, too. Your original plan, I assume, was to get intel on Azam by using his mistress. But that scheme is sunk, man. And you have to know that. Now you are just holding her for no good reason.
Voland laughed.
Don't be ridiculous. You might have us surrounded, but now we have you. Your men out there won't dare attack us for fear of you getting killed in the process. I could shoot you myself, in fact.
Of course you could, but it won't help you. Just like you, I'm not running the show.
Voland's white eyebrows furrowed.
What does that mean?
Drexler did not answer immediately. Voland's chin jutted out a bit. Drexler wondered if it was real confidence or fictitious bluster.
And you don't know what assets we have assembled here on the estate to protect her.
Drexler replied.
I'm sure you're hinting about your American. I hear he was quite good, but I do not believe he is here.
Voland smiled now.
Attack the house and find out.
Drexler stared Voland down, trying to determine if he was telling the truth.
Who is he?
Voland maintained his grin.
He is the Gray Man.
Drexler leaned back against the wall, confident and relaxed.
I was almost ready to believe you, but then you ventured off into fantasy land.
Believe what you want, Drexler.
Matters not. We've been watching the house. We know who's here. None of my people have reported any mythical uber-assassin sightings.
Voland said,
He is still part of our team. If something happens to any of us, he'll come for you.
I seriously doubt that. You aren't as important as you think you are. Why would the world-famous Gray Man take on such a futile assignment for the Halopis?
Voland did not answer the question. Drexler determined with certainty that the Frenchman had been lying. Now Voland asked,
Since we are having such a frank conversation, why don't you tell me who is out in the trees?
Drexler did not hesitate.
14 Quds Force-trained commandos of the Syrian GIS. Their leader has worked for me in the past all over Europe. Perhaps he is not the Gray Man, but I can assure you he does exist, and he is here.
Do you take me for an idiot? Azam himself controls GIS paramilitary forces. You are working against Azam for his wife.
What must be going on in that head of yours right now? You calculated that Shakira would send me up here to kill Bianca, because that had been my original mission. Yes, I figured out that you have somehow intercepted my communications with the ISIS cell in Belgium. You know who I am working for, so that is why you are confused as to what GIS is doing here. They work for Ahmed, after all, the unfaithful husband, not Shakira, the jilted wife. Well, as I said, it is more complicated. I have changed alliances mid-operation. I only want to bring Bianca home to her child.
This was a lie, of course, but Drexler had determined there would be a greater chance he could get Voland and the entire house to surrender if they felt Medina would not be harmed. Voland swallowed, and Drexler could see the true fear of a man unaccustomed to being outsmarted.
The leader you spoke of, is he the one they call Malik?
One and the same. He killed 4 counter-terror police in Bruges last year. Not my operation. And this is certainly no official channel corroboration, but I can confirm he was the gunman. Multiply him by 14, and that's what you're facing right now, if you do not agree to my terms. When Voland did not reply, Drexler said,
all you need to do to prevent a bloodbath is to allow Bianca to leave with me. She will return to Syria unharmed, and you will survive.
Voland looked to the tile floor for a long time. Drexler felt bad for the old man. So many miscalculations.
If what you say is true, if you could take this building over at will, why would you let me live?
I'm glad you asked that, Vincent. I won't be working for Syrian interests much longer. I will turn that page and take on something new. I have beaten you tonight, but I have need of men like you. I use people in the field, yes, but they are paid well for their work. As I mentioned, I've studied your career. And you are a good intelligence officer. Not great. You haven't been willing to stick your neck out when operational duties required it, but you've done your best. I will offer you survival tonight, and in exchange, I would hope you might consider my requests for contract work in the future.
Voland seemed stunned by it all, the employment offer included.
I've made the last several years of my life about putting you in a French prison. Now you want me to serve as your hired hand?
Drexler shrugged. You needn't die for a lost cause. I would much rather put you to work.
It was silent in the room for most of a minute. Then the Frenchman stood on unsteady legs. As he turned away, he spoke softly, almost to himself.
I must talk to Duhelabis to discuss your terms.
By all means.
Chapter 43. Tucked between the sofa and the chair in the complete darkness on the back patio of Bianca Medina's Damascus home, Court tuned his ears to the scene around him, listening for any movement either inside the home or out on the grounds of the house. He knew from Bianca that the baby's room was in the southern wing on the second floor, and Yasmin slept right there in the room with him, so he considered climbing outside of the house and trying to gain access via the balcony. But again, the alarm code would be impossible to defeat without tools, so he was hoping he would be able to wait for someone to turn it off. He checked his watch and saw it was 1:30. He told himself he'd give it another 20 minutes before taking down the patrolling guard for the access code. He felt like he had to get to the Jordanian border well before first light, so he couldn't wait much longer. And then, right before his eyes, the light on the keypad turned from red to green. Someone was on his or her way into or out of one of the doors, though he saw no movement at any of the 3 ground floor doors in front of him. A sound came from the balcony above. Soft footsteps, right over Court's head. Apparently a single individual had exited there, and now he or she stood at the railing, looking out over the rear courtyard. Court wondered if it was Yasmin, but then it occurred to him that he'd been lucky enough to see the alarm deactivated in the first place. There was no way in hell he could be so lucky as to have the woman he needed to grab make it that easy for him. Just as he decided now was the time to head for the door, he could hear the footsteps turning away, heading back to the house. Court realized the person above might reset the alarm as soon as he or she was inside. He looked around quickly, stood up, and darted towards the sliding door to the bedroom, since he'd identified this as one of the 3 doors easiest to breach. First, he tested it, making certain it was locked. When it did not slide open, he knelt and leaned against the glass, put his right hand under the handle, and shoved it up while coming up higher on his legs. The door lifted a fraction of an inch in the track, but the latch held. He did this a second and third time, worrying he was making too much noise, but aware this was still the quietest way to get into the house. On the 4th try, the latch popped up audibly, and Court lowered the glass door back down into the track and slid it open. He stepped inside, then turned to close the door. The alarm keypad on the bedroom wall beeped softly, and the light remained green. The man upstairs had indeed tried to set it, but he received a warning that this downstairs bedroom door had been open. Court had been too slow. Quickly, Court closed and locked the door, and he turned to find a place to hide, but before he could move, he heard a different soft beep from the keypad. The alarm turned from green to red. The man upstairs had tried again to arm the alarm, and this time it had worked. Court knew if the man was any good at his job, he would either call someone to have them check on this bedroom door, or else he'd come do it himself. Court wanted to be out of the middle of the downstairs bedroom before that happened. He hurried over to the ensuite bathroom and stepped inside, tucking himself behind a half-open door, while pulling Walid's fixed blade knife. The wait was interminable, but eventually footsteps in the hall indicated someone had come to check the door. Said Alawi flipped on the light to the spare bedroom and looked around. He held a walkie-talkie in his left hand, and he brought his right hand down to the pistol on his belt there. The room was empty. He glanced into the dark bathroom as he headed around the bed to check on the door, but he didn't go in. Instead, he looked outside on the patio first, then pulled on the door, making sure it was indeed properly locked. He was already glad he hadn't broadcast over the radio the fact that he'd received the alarm exception message, because clearly there was nothing to worry about. Still, Alawi found this curious. He'd been working here since just before the birth of the child, and the alarm had never once erroneously signaled an open door when the door was locked. Also, none of the other security men on the premises should have been in this wing of the home. He wondered if the new guy outside had come in to take a leak, or if one of the other men in the house had gone outside for a stroll. No one was supposed to move from his post, either static or mobile, without first making a request to the agent in charge. Alawi wasn't the agent in charge, but he would have heard the transmission in his earpiece, and he'd heard nothing over the radio in the past hour. He decided he needed to find out if there was either a problem with the alarm system or a problem with one of the new guys following orders. He reached for the transmit button on the radio on his belt, and as he did so, he turned away from the glass door and back towards the well-lit bedroom. And then he stopped. A uniformed soldier stood in front of him, feet away, near the threshold to the bathroom. Alawi was confused.
"Who are you?"
Court launched at the guard, desperate to get to him before he made a noise. The American knocked the radio away with a backhand, then punched the man in the jaw, staggering him on his knees. He began to fall backwards into the glass door, but Court leapt closer, caught him by the collar, and spun him around back into the room. Court punched him hard in the face again, knocking him unconscious onto the bed. Court then moved over to the door to the room and shut and locked it softly, then flipped the lights off again. Court stood there in the darkness of what was obviously a guest bedroom, and he shook the pain out of his right hand. His jab had hit more cheekbone than he'd intended, and his fourth and fifth fingers throbbed from the impact. Back at the unconscious man, Court rolled him face first off the bed and onto the floor of the bedroom, knelt on the man's back, and grabbed his head. With a single swift movement, Court pulled and turned, snapping the guard's neck and killing him. He stripped the man of his shoes, his suit, his shirt, his tie, and all the while he listened to the walkie-talkie on the floor for any hint that the guards of the premises were alerted to the noise or absence of this man. Court stripped his uniform off and dressed in the guard's clothing. It fit a lot better than Walid's too loose tunic and too short pants. Then Court put the Desert Hawks Brigade uniform on the dead body. This was surprisingly arduous work that took him nearly 5 minutes, but when he was through, after he'd holstered the guard's big SIG pistol and clipped the radio onto his own belt, he knew he would be able to move through the darkened house more easily now. He put the earpiece in his ear and began rifling through the man's identification, hoping to learn his name. But the writing was in Arabic, so Court just pocketed the wallet and dragged the body into the bathroom. Here, he placed it in the bathtub, closed the curtain, and headed back for the door that would lead him to the rest of the home. Chapter 44. Vincent Voland sat with Rima and Tarek in the library of the French estate, while Drexler was kept under guard in the hearthroom by Boyer. Voland told the Syrian couple about the offer made by Drexler, and he added,
"I don't know why the Syrian GIS men are here, but this changes the equation totally. None of us stand a chance against..."
"You want us to surrender?"
Rima screamed it as the realization came to her. Voland held up his hands.
Face the facts. They will kill every last one of us in here, and we will lose Medina anyway. If we withdraw, then perhaps we...
Tarek snapped now.
By withdraw, you mean run away.
We will have our chance, I feel certain. Just at a